couldn't tell whether I was actually describing the grammar correctly, that is, whether my grammar accounted for all the examples. So this is 20 years later, 15 years later, and we have a team of people that's working on it, as you can see, grammar writers and other people. Let me start out with a question to you all. What was created 1,000 or 2,000 or more years ago that is still useful today? Okay, and I'll come back to that at the end of the talk. Let's start with an assumption about grammars that language is one of the most complex things that any of us learn, and that a good part of that complexity is due to the grammar of the language. Another part of it, of course, is due to the lexicon of the language, but the grammar is certainly difficult. And then let's talk about some values. As Stephen Bird and Gary Simons wrote in their Seven Pillars of whatever that article title was,
Seven Dimensions
of Language Description Documentation. If we can agree on some values, we can decide where to go. And I think one of the values is clearly that grammatical description is valuable. I shouldn't have to argue that in here. Some people might disagree, think that we should take a broad approach. But at least for some languages, it seems like we should take an in-depth approach and describe their grammars in as much detail as we can. Grammar should be understandable, at least by linguists. They should be reliable. I'll come back to this point. That is to say, in conjunction with lexicons, they should generate all and only the attested or the relevant structures of the language. Furthermore, our research should be reproducible. That is, somebody else should be able to come along and determine that, in fact, we were right, that our grammar is reliable, and not have to rely on our statement as the original researchers that it's so. Clearly, grammars like lexicons and text should be archived, and therefore they have to be archivable. And finally, I think they should be multi-purposable. We should be able to use them to understand texts in the language. We might want to use them for language learning. I'll be talking here about descriptive and computational grammars. I will not be talking about pedagogical grammars, but still, in some sense, that a grammar should be usable for learning, and so forth. Oh, and then there is another post-final that I think grammar should be enjoyable. Okay, let's start with descriptive grammars. I think we all know what a descriptive grammar is. The question is, how good are they? These comments, the first comment here comes from an email between Jonathan Amath, who was a researcher writing a grammar of a dialect of Nahuatl, and me. I was writing the morphological parser, a computational tool that would analyze text in Nahuatl. And I was asking him to explain his grammar because it seemed to me that it was ambiguous or it left a hole. And that's not Jonathan's fault necessarily. That's something that all grammars share. All grammars, human grammars, tend to be ambiguous. They leave holes, gaps, things that are hard to understand. And this shows up in many ways. Many years ago, there was research done, a grammar written of Yawamani, Yolumna, language of California. And that grammar formed the basis later on for a lot of the work that was done in theoretical phonology in the 1980s. And it turned out that the interpretation of the theory researcher was just plain wrong, that he misunderstood the grammar, and that the forms that he was using as the basis for his theory didn't actually exist in Yawamani. We could multiply many of these examples many times. So is it really that bad? Laurie Bauer, a typologist, has this comment, and basically she's saying that the grammars are almost useless for her, the morphological grammars. So if languages and grammars really are this complicated, the most complex thing, then it's no wonder we can't debug them in our heads. We can't figure out whether the grammar description that we've written actually describes the language well or not. And the question is, can we do better than that? Well, there is another kind of grammar, a computational grammar, one which the computer can take and apply to analyze texts. And this has some different properties. Many years ago, an MIT professor, no, not that MIT professor, J.C.R. Licklider, proposed that in the future, and this was 1960, that computers would be used to test hypotheses. So we could, in under this principle, we could write a grammar of a language, and we could then use the computer to test whether that grammar that we had written actually worked. There are such programs nowadays. There are morphological parsers, syntactic parsers, and you can write a description of the grammar of a language and then process a corpus with it and see how much your grammar accounts for. But they work for specific models, specific theories of language, and most linguists don't know how to use them. In fact, most linguists find them very hard to use. Oops, I went one page back. So here's an example of a grammar. This is the one that I was writing for Jonathan Amoth of Nawat. And up there are a couple rules of this grammar. The first one is an epenthesis rule, and the second one is part of a reduplication rule. And if you can understand this without knowing anything about the programming language that was used here, is the Xerox finite state transducer, you're better than me. This is a very opaque formalism. Lots of things that aren't the way that a linguist would think of doing it. So the first problem with these computational grammars is that their formalism is opaque. The second problem, which I'll come to in a moment, is that the lifetime of a computational grammar is limited. And the third problem is that there's no direct connection between the computational grammar and the descriptive grammar. So I put comments in there, and then the comments in the example are the things that appear after exclamation points. I put comments in there that link back to what Jonathan had written about Nawat. But if he changed his analysis or changed his spelling, changed the way he glossed words, there's nothing that would automatically convert my comments so that they corresponded to what he said in his grammar. So that's a problem. All those things are problems. So let's come to the second problem that I said. This problem number two, lifetime of computational grammars is limited. Is that really true? I can't prove it so much with parsers, but I can prove it with a parser that I wrote and the programming languages that it was written in. This was a project, an SIL, LinguaLinks project back in the early 90s, and I was writing a parser which I called Hermit Crab. It used three programming languages, Prolog and C, and the user interface was in LinguaLinks, which itself was written in Smalltalk. And by the end of this project, all three of those programming languages had become obsolete. And when I tried to rewrite the parser, I had quite a bit of work to do to make that work in the new versions of this programming languages. So any grammars that had been written using this parser were endangered grammars because the parser wasn't going to work anymore. An emulator might be a way to solve this problem. If anybody wants to bring that up later, we can talk about that. So this shelf life problem is not caused so much by the short life of the parser itself, but by the short life of the programming language that the parser uses. So here again is one of those rules that I wrote in Xerox FST. In some days, Xerox FST will be defunct, and maybe we could port this grammar over to another one. So I've put up the corresponding rule in the Stuttgart finite state transducer, another programming environment for rules, grammar rules. And you can see that it's very, very different. Yes, you could probably convert it, but there are an awful lot of rules in the Nawat grammar, and it would take an awful lot of work to do that conversion. And it would take somebody, moreover, who understood both the Xerox and the Stuttgart formats. So this is what I mean by the shelf life problem. You write a grammar for one parser, that parser becomes obsolete, and you have to convert it to somebody else's parser, and maybe by that time you've retired or some other event has happened, and it's not going to happen. So the shelf life of your grammar is shortened. And I think in the future it's only going to get worse because we'll have much better parsers which are capable of better things than our current finite state transducers, and their input programming languages are going to be still different. Okay, so how do we solve it? Well, what we need is a parser-independent and stable formalism for writing our grammar rules. It has to be a reasonable, from a linguistic standpoint, at least has to be observationally adequate. I'm going back to the other MIT professor now who talked about observational, descriptive, and explanatory adequacy. We don't really care about descriptive and explanatory adequacy. We're worried about observational adequacy. Can we actually analyze the constructs of the language? it ought to cooperate with other formalisms that already exist. It should be reasonably understandable, not Baroque formalism, and has to be documented, and of course it has to be in Unicode. And then there's a problem of how we take this formalism and convert it into an actual parser. I'll come back to that in a few slides. So the notation that we've developed is based on a linguistic model. Most of it is identical to what's in SIL's Fieldworks Language Explorer Flex. We've implemented it in XML. The model specifically does not use real modern linguistic theory, so there's nothing in there about optimality theory and so forth. But it does allow you to handle, as far as I know, virtually all the constructs that you'll find in the morphology of languages, with the possible exception of under application of phonological rules in reduplicants. And as I say, observational adequacy and understandability of the formalism is the goal. So I've got two slides here that talk about the coverage, first in terms of the morphology, and we can come back to these if somebody wants to ask me questions later, and then in terms of the phonology. As I say at the bottom, there's a converter that converts this into a parser, and there's some parts that are incomplete, but they're doable in principle. So how do we convert this to the parser? Well, there's several steps. The grammar is typically written in pieces. That is the formal grammar that I've been talking about in this XML formalism. And it's scattered throughout a regular descriptive grammar. We bring all those pieces together and convert, put them into one file. And then I have a computer program which is written to process that file, convert it into an internal representation, and then spit out the programming language for whatever parsing engine we happen to be using, which currently is the Stuttgart finite state transducer. And then we run that finite state transducer over the program that the converter has spit out, and presto, we have a parser, and we can run it over text. This is a morphological and phonological parser. It does not do syntax. Okay, so the problems that I mentioned with regard to computational grammars as opposed to descriptive grammars, the opacity of the formalism, the fact that you look at the Xerox FST code or the Stuttgart FST code and it looks like mumbo jumbo. Hopefully we've solved that. You'll have to take that on for granted for a moment until I show you some shots of this XML formalism. I believe we've solved the lifetime of the formalism problem because we have a stable formalism. We can convert it into the Stuttgart finite state transducer today, and someday down the road when there's a better morphological parsing engine, we can convert it into that formalism as well. Finally, there's a third problem that I mentioned, the connection between descriptive and formal grammar. How do we solve that issue? Well, I'd like to step back for a moment. I talked about descriptive grammars or reference grammars and computational grammars, and there are a number of characteristics that they each have. So a descriptive grammar, a reference grammar of the type that people write, of the type that Dr. Lehmann was showing us, these are understandable for the most part by humans. You may have to have some linguistics training, whereas a computational grammar is generally not easy to understand, unless you know that particular formalism. On the other hand, a human-readable grammar, a descriptive grammar, is not processable by a computer. Computers don't understand English or any other language of wider communication, so you can't tell them to take your grammar description and turn it into a parser. But a computational grammar is exactly that. It's designed for the computer to process. Human languages tend to be ambiguous, as we saw with the Nawat grammar, where I was asking him what he meant, or the Yawamani grammar, whereas computational grammars, the formalism is explicitly designed not to be ambiguous. We can put inline examples, interlinear text in our descriptive grammars. We can't put them really into computational grammars. We could put paradigm tables and other test data, inline examples, interlinear text, paradigms, all these things into our descriptive grammars. And we can't really do that except put them in as comments in the computational grammar. On the other hand, the computational grammar is debuggable. We can actually test it and see whether it works. Finally, alternative analyses. If you really don't understand how something is working in the language, then you can certainly write that up in your descriptive grammar. Or if you say, well, this is another way of looking at it, you can write that up, whereas computational grammars really don't allow for that. Now, you all are good linguists, so I'm sure you've noticed that the yeses and the noes here, or the yeses, I should say, are in complementary distribution between these two. What does that suggest to you as linguists? Well, we should find some way of combining the descriptive grammar and the computational grammar into one, I'll call it an eme, as in phoneme. Okay, how do we do that? Well, fortunately, this problem was solved a number of years ago by Donald Knuth, a professor at Stanford, who wanted to know how he could take computer programs, he being a computer scientist, and make them into something that's actually readable by humans and maybe even enjoyable. And he invented this thing he called literate programming, where the idea was to scatter the pieces of the computer program throughout a prose description of what the computer program did, and then be able to extract the computer code out of it, put it back together, and turn it into a program. Well, that's exactly what we want to do with our computational formalism. We want to scatter it through a regular descriptive grammar and then be able to extract it and convert it, as I talked about earlier. Notice that the order of exposition does not need to be the same in the descriptive grammar as it is in the final computational grammar. This didn't go over real well with most computer scientists. Some of them did it, but there are a number of reasons. Number one, computer scientists are notoriously bad, Donald Knuth being an exception. They're notoriously bad at describing what they've done. They rather write code than English, but you know, linguists are different. And second, computer programs are getting longer and longer, whereas grammars tend to be reasonably short, at least by the standards of a lot of software today. So I think there's reason to think that we might succeed in doing this. Here's the process. We take a descriptive grammar, that's the thing up there in the upper left-hand corner, and our formal grammar, and we combine it together into a single XML document. From which we can go two paths. We can take the left-hand path and turn that into a printable document or a PDF or whatever, or HTML pages, or we can go in the right-hand path and combine that with words out of a dictionary to produce a morphological parser. I won't go through the details on this unless anybody wants me to, but we actually have this, both of these paths working at the moment. So here's our descriptive grammar in XML. Now, somebody commented earlier that they didn't like to deal with XML. I can't understand that. It looks perfectly fine to me, but our grammar writers, as it turns out, agree with those people who say it's hard to read. So we've been using a tool called XML Mind. It's freely available. You can also purchase a version of it. And in XML Mind, that XML document that I showed you on the previous page looks something like this. It's not quite WYSIWYG. It's a little, there are some tags in there that you probably don't see as tags, but it is basically something that our grammar writers are quite comfortable with writing in. The formal grammar is also XML. It looks something like that. And again, that's not what you might call user-friendly. So I've been experimenting with converting that XML code that you see up there at the top into something that is actually not only displayable in the XML Mind tool, but also editable, so that people could actually write formal grammar rules in something like that that looks a little bit more like what they're used to seeing. There's still improvements on this, but that's the plan. And finally, we can typeset that. We can do what Donald Knuth called weaving it and convert that whole thing into a PDF that I think looks pretty nice. We can publish it as a book. We could also convert it into HTML using publicly available tools for the most part. Okay, Yapa is a Quechua term, language of South America. It means sort of like the 13th in a baker's dozen. It's the extra thing that you get. The grammar gives us test data. So every one of our inline examples, our interlinear examples, and so forth, is a test case for the parser. What this does is it gives us those reproducible results. So I can claim that our parser has 95% coverage or whatever. You can take my grammar, you can extract it, and put it into Stuttgart finite state transducer, run it over my test cases, and you can see whether it actually works or not. That doesn't eliminate the need for other kinds of test cases, tests that you might get out of corpora, but at least it goes to show that what I've claimed in the grammar, what our grammar writers have claimed is the right analysis, actually works. So at the present, we've written two grammars like this, the languages of Bangla and Urdu. We've currently written a Pashto grammar in the descriptive format. We haven't finished the formal grammar as yet. The Bangla and Urdu parsers actually work. They can be automatically compiled out of our formal grammar formalism. And we're moving ahead. We have started work on other languages, Punjabi and Devehi. Now, all of these happen to be Indo-European languages, but we will undoubtedly be working on non-Indo-European languages in the near future. There's considerable amount of work that still needs to be done. I would like to develop better tools, for example, for editing that formal grammar and for displaying it in our PDFs at the end of the process. And we have not done anything with syntax at this point. So coming back to the values that I started at the beginning, we think this is valuable to do. We think that the combination of a descriptive grammar and a formal grammar is understandable. We believe that we've got a reliable way of producing these parsers that, in conjunction with a dictionary, a lexicon, they can generate the forms that we claim. Our research is reproducible. Somebody can take our analysis and test it out and see if it really does what we say it does. They're definitely archivable. They're in XML format, and it's a stable formalism. And finally, they're multi-purposable. So we can take, for instance, somebody brought up the question of having parts of the grammar marked for different audiences earlier. We do that routinely. We mark some sections for technical people, linguists, and we mark other parts for people who aren't interested in all those details, and we can produce a PDF that either includes or does not include the technical parts. And I think at the end here, my final point, grammar should be enjoyable. I think I'd like to X out that maybe there. I think the grammars definitely should be enjoyable, and we enjoy working on these ourselves. So coming back to that question I asked at the beginning, what is it that was built 1,000, 2,000 years ago that's still usable today? Somebody may tell me that this isn't a Roman bridge, but I'm going to claim at least that it's a Roman bridge that was built almost 2,000 years ago, and you can still use it today. Some other things that were built thousands of years ago that can still be used today are grammars. The upper left-hand corner there is Tamil from I don't know how many thousands of years ago, written on palm leaves. The right-hand, that stamp over there, is commemorating Panini, a famous Sanskrit linguist. The bust is a Roman who did a Latin grammar. And that other document there is an Irish grammar of over 1,000 years ago. We can still use these things today. They're still useful. They document the forms of languages that were spoken thousands of years ago. So will our grammar still be usable thousands of years from now? I'd like to think that they will, and I'd like to think that they'll be more accurate maybe than Panini's and those other grammars were. We would be able to test them, and future grammarians, future linguists will also be able to test them. Thank you.